Hello, I'm Adam, and welcome to Tales from the Potting Bench, a gardening podcast where you'll hear tales and stories from the most interesting and different people from the world of both indoor and outdoor gardening. Now, we're back for a whopping fifth season of the podcast with new guests and brand new stories and conversations with some people you would definitely know and some people that you'll come to know and love. If this is the first time that you're listening, then welcome. These conversations are really eye-opening, and the people that I talk to really open up about their true love of plants and what it is that brought them to that world in the first place. Once again, I'm thrilled to say that this podcast is proudly sponsored by the wonderful people at PlantGrow, producers of award-winning organic compost, mulch and fertiliser made with zero chemicals. Great for your garden and even greater for the planet, and I know because it's all that I use in my garden. And don't forget, if you use the code POTTINGBENCH on plantgrow.co.uk, you'll get 10% off your order. But before we get into this week's episode, I'd like to ask, if you listen to this podcast and enjoy it, then please consider rating and leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice. It's dead easy to do, takes a few minutes of your time, but it helps this podcast get into the ears of more like-minded planty people. So, we're kicking this season off with a huge guest and someone that I wanted to talk to since the podcast first began. This week, I'm joined by writer, gardener, and someone who describes their Instagram page as being full of gardening, hens, bees, and flamingos, the wonderful Arthur Parkinson. In this extra special longer episode, we discuss Arthur's introduction to gardening, his unique approach, and how his style is completely changing as everything else around us also changes. And we discuss Arthur's upcoming new book. Enjoy. So, for anyone who is not familiar with you right now, who are you and what do you do?
I am somebody who spends too much time on Instagram. I'm a photographer of butterflies and flowers and chickens, a writer on all of those as well, as much as I can get most work published. And I am a gardener, but I don't really make my money off gardening. So I'm a home gardener rather than someone who's out there gardening for people. And I do cut flowers as well. But again, not every week. You know, I do kind of seasonal parties and things like that. and yeah, I suppose in a nutshell, influencer, but an influencer on chickens and gardens and bugs, I suppose, and crazy clips that I find funny off the telly.
You know, I've got that as a I've said this to you before, but I purposely don't make notes. But one of the things that I've got, which is literally just a bullet point of French and Saunders.
Yeah.
I love that. I love the variety of it. If I see you posted a story, it could either be a chicken, a gardening, like something to do with gardening, but 9 times out of 10, it's French and Saunders.
I tell you, when I first saw Dawn French was a thing that she did called Murder Most Horrid.
Yeah. With
a lot of people will, you know, I'm 30 and my mum was very broad-minded with me and my brother Lyndon. And there was one episode of Murder Most Horrid where Dawn French played a Blue Peter presenter who ended up murdering people because she was jealous. She wanted to be the top presenter. So my mum let me and my brother watch that. And we must have only been about 6 or 7. Dawn French played, this television presenter Dawn French played was Bunty, and I just found it so funny from that young age. And so I kind of bypassed Vicar of Dibley and went on to French and Saunders, because, you know, back then it was only 30 years ago, but there was only the 4 channels.
Yeah.
So, you know, French and Saunders Christmas special, that would be the highlight of Christmas from a very young age.
I remember Murder Most Horrid. You know, you've unlocked a memory that I'd completely forgotten. Amazing. I remember the theme tune and everything.
Yeah, Murder Most Horrid.
I never thought I'd be duetting the Murder Most Horrid theme tune with you. Well, obviously we've got to talk about flowers. It's impossible to not talk about flowers. I think you've had quite an interesting kind of route in. For anyone that doesn't know, like how has this 30-year-old guy from, are you from, is it Nottinghamshire or is it Lincolnshire?
Nottingham, a place called Hucknall. So yeah, kind of ex-mining town, what was Greenbelt cities. Nottingham's a very small city, but it's surrounded by lots of little towns that all connect.
So how did this guy from the Nottinghamshire area turn into what we know Arthur Parkinson to be today.
Well, it's interesting. I was talking to someone yesterday about children. This person had got their grandkids coming around, and they were dreading it because the grandkids just treat the granny's house like it's playtime. But me and my brother Lyndon, we had two sets of grandparents, and with my dad's mum in particular, called Min, she really would set us to work, and I, out of all the grandkids, was the one that was able to be trusted to plant out the purple sprout and broccoli, and was fairly good at cutting the hedge, and enjoyed it to a point. And then I think slowly, I mean, the chickens, wanting to have chickens, that made me more interested in the garden because I kept chickens in her garden, and they wreaked havoc at first because they were the wrong breeds, and so they trashed the vegetable beds. And so finding myself as that little boy trying to guard the cabbage against my chickens, I suppose that all helped me be interested. But my mum, as well as showing us Murder Most Horrid, was very good at showing me and my brother wildlife and gardening. Just looking back, got so lucky to have a mum who would go to the market and buy wallflowers, and we didn't have much money, but she always made the most of our garden. I do remember her growing the her favorite dahlia was Arabian Night, and I remember we used to buy a tuber every year and plant it. So just things like that. And then what happened was I was a bit of a dunce at school. Was not academic at all. Couldn't tie my shoelaces. So left school with hardly any GCSEs, and my dad particularly was despairing, and he said, "You're going to have to learn a trade, otherwise you're not going to survive." And obviously plumbing and being an electrician was out the window. I mean, I can't even wire a plug. So I ended up managing to get myself on a, I think it must have been the RHS level two at Brackenhurst College, which is in Southwell, near Southwell Minster. And that Brackenhurst was owned by Nottingham Trent Uni. So was really lucky to get on that course, and had a wonderful tutor called Caroline. And she was married to a really nice guy called Paul, who looked after all the greenhouses. So I had a really nice time doing my RHS level two, and learnt to pot up things and just enjoyed it. And so then did that kind of all through that. I was working actually at Pets at Home.
All
So
right.
I know a lot about goldfish, because I was in the fish section.
I'm expecting a goldfish book then soon. So the next logical step.
Maybe. So and then suddenly started to emerge as someone who liked to get the train down to London. Reasons we won't go into, but for that reason, that led me to start applying for jobs in London. And one of the jobs was a traineeship at Kew Gardens for a year. That I later learned the only reason I got was because they liked the drawings I did on the envelope.
Oh, really? Is that true?
I remember going, you know, when like you're not used to interviews and you're young and you end up wearing your dad's old suit. And it was a really hot day, and I just remember going to London. I'd never been to London on my own before, getting into a cab from St Pancras, being charged like 50 quid by the time we got to Kew, and then arriving dripping with sweat. And they ask you, "So how many Latin names do you know, and do you know any plant families?" The only plant family I could say was Boraginaceae. That literally was it. So I left thinking there's absolutely no way I'm going to get that, because back then it was, it probably still is, but a lot of career changing people go into gardening. So I was one of the youngest going into that like group of trainees, but I managed it somehow by the skin of my teeth quite often. There were some really hairy moments, and I really struggled to settle into London because I'd come from a place where all my family was around the corner within a 10-minute walk, going to London, not knowing a soul, and being in quite an academic horticultural world that I didn't fit into, because I never did learn Latin. I used to write down the Latin names on my arm when we had the horrible Latin tests that involved knowing about five different species of conifer that I'd never had no interest in.
Do you feel like you've retained that some of the, well, you'll have retained some of it, obviously, but the
Yeah,
Latin.
I think the wonderful skill of being trained in horticulture from a practical is, I did 6 months in the propagation department, which was 6 months of taking cuttings and really nurturing batches of bedding plants, and getting the standard of hygiene very high, and being very delegated to your charges. Learning how to water was a massive thing. Like every morning, your head of section would you'd follow her She was called Ginny, and she taught us to be able to know when a plant needed to be watered by lifting the pot and feeling the weight. It was just creating like a natural affinity with plants that you really need, I think, if you're going to be successful at propagation. And you know, it was good, but I never really did learn how to reverse a tractor and trailer. In fact, I nearly crashed one in a tree. It was quite ab fabby looking back.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wasn't fired. I would turn up a bit like Patsy on my head, and
Not with a glass there, hopefully. Glass in
not with a glass, but with a lot of substance in my body from the night before. The thing that I redeemed myself by doing was catching a peacock. So I wasn't called Arthur. I was known as the Peacock Boy, because he was the one who was able to catch a peacock that was causing havoc in the Kew Plaza, which was like the public bit. And this
Right.
peacock got an injured foot. And all the macho arboreal department had tried to catch this peacock by using fishing nets and chasing it around for hours. And I just crouched down with a handful of digestive biscuits and waited for Mr. Peacock to stop pecking out my hand, and then grabbed its talons and tucked it under my arm like I'd done it every single day of my life. And I remember the guys waiting for me on like this gator, after they'd had to radio the head of Kew to say, is it okay for Arthur to attempt to catch the peacock? And they were waiting for the go-ahead from like the office far, far away. And eventually we got the go-ahead, and within 10 seconds, Mr. Peacock was under my arm, and we went to the vets with the peacock.
Oh, wow.
That
So,
night.
did you do the Q diploma? Was that the year? Is that a year long thing that you did? Was
No,
that?
thank God it wasn't the diploma. It was something called the traineeship that lasted mercifully for a year, which was enough. I don't think I would have lasted 3 years doing. I mean, it was very intense, but the Kew diploma is something else entirely. You know, you're sent off to do botany, aren't you, in amazing
Yeah.
wildflower meadows. And I think I realised very quickly I was the kind of gardener who wanted to go down the route of harvesting the garden, and you know, picking the flowers and seeing it more as something that is a harvest rather than something just to look at, which is where Sarah Raven came in quite strongly. Because you know, I remember discovering her books and realizing that was what I wanted the garden to be, you know, full of gorgeous flowers. But
Yeah.
for it to be a harvest, just like having a vegetable garden is a harvest.
Yeah.
But bizarrely, despite my nana being very good at vegetable gardening, I wasn't interested in it, I think because I didn't find it very pretty.
So it'd be impossible to not just quickly touch on Sarah. How did that relationship come about? For anyone that doesn't know that you've got incredible friendship with Sarah, how did that come about? Because from the outside, and this is what I love about it, and if I were pushed to say what my favorite podcast is, it would be the episodes of Grow It Arrange that you've done with Sarah. Because I just think that
Thank
from the outside, I mean, this is my brain perhaps, but from the outside, it's such an unlikely friendship or an unlikely relationship, or one that you don't necessarily see. But you've got such an incredible dynamic, and you've just clearly got a bond. Just, not just on flowers, but that's clearly a mutual passion that you've got. But how did that come about?
Well, what I'd say to anybody, regardless of how old they are, is if you admire anybody, try and write them a letter. I really stand by that. You know, if you're a young person and you want to work somewhere, write a very nice letter. And if they're a nice person, they'll write back to you. And so yeah, I sent Sarah a letter, and then while I lived in London, I just got the train up to Perch Hill for one of the open days that still happen. And Sarah was there on the veg bank, surrounded by a posse of ladies talking about mustard red frills or whatever salad it was. And I just marched up to didn't march up to her. I was very, very polite and said, "Hello, Sarah, I really admire you." And she just looked at me and she said, "Oh, look, it would be lovely to have a chat at the end of the day." So I stayed till the end of the day, and we had a lovely chat and a cup of tea. And I think we are very similar, actually, in a number of ways. And it is a very genuine friendship that I hold very dear. And I think she's one of the most undersung heroes of the gardening world, what she's done. It really annoys me that she's not mentioned more, because her style and flair. And when she was on Gardener's World, she was an incredible presenter. She's an amazing teacher. And so I've been very, very lucky to be in her midst. And you know, I witnessed her for a long time teaching, and then slowly, slowly I started teaching with her. And now occasionally I still teach with her on the away days. So you get me for the afternoon if you book on a course. And And but I think what really bonded us was cutting the way I did flowers. She came back from holiday. I'd been house sitting for her, looking after the dogs and the chickens, and she came back and I think she said something like, "Gosh, I've never had a gardener who's cut me flowers as a welcome home." And she said, "You've done them so beautifully. Can you do this all the time?" And so I started doing the photo shoots, and they're an amazing thing. A collaboration between me, Sarah, Josie, a head gardener who grows it all, along with the team at Perch, and then Jonathan Butley, who photographs it all. This year, I've not been doing that because I've been quite busy, so I've kind of taken a step back. But for about 4 years, I was doing that with Sarah. The catalogue is such a beautiful, authentic thing, and I think because me and Sarah both love wildflowers and everything to be tumbling and full, even though they're cultivated varieties, dahlias and tulips, you can't get much more cultivated than those two classes of flowers. The way we like to grow them and arrange them reflects the style of a wildflower meadow, bizarrely, because neither of us like to, just cut a flower that's stumpy in a stumpy little vase. We want it like an amazing Georgian hat with an egret feather sticking out of it
Yeah,
almost.
of course.
So yeah, and they're very lucky to have been taken under Sarah's wing, because she's turned out, she's been so grateful, really.
I think there's a theme there that runs through that relationship of cut flowers in particular. I feel like cut flowers are incredibly I don't know, underrated, or the artistry of cut flowers and the skill behind cut flowers is either incredibly underrated or really underrepresented. And it's not just a, I'm not saying it's overthought, but it's not just a cut and bung them in a vase. There's an incredible skill to it, and when you watch someone really arranging and thinking about what they're doing, it's like watching a, I liken it to like watching a lava lamp, and you just can't look away. Do you know what I mean?
It can be. I mean, I think I'm becoming much more of a plonker than an arranger lately. There's nothing I like more than having lovely single stem vases, and my favourites are the vintage ones that are known as bubble vases that have got a weight at the bottom, and they're in kind of like clear but coloured glass. And I love just having a river of those down a table, or on a dressing table, and just a few flowers in each of the out the garden. I mean, it's I just I hate shop bought flowers. I can't abide them, actually. I just find the cellophane around them just kills any beauty instantly. And the wonderful thing about a lot of cut flowers is they are naturally good for bees. So it's best of both worlds, really, for me, someone who is very passionate about having a garden that's good for bees. The cut flowers kind of go hand in hand in that. And there's been a real resurgence in the cut flower movement. Sarah started it, and I think since Instagram, it's just got bigger and bigger. You've got Willow Crosley now, and that wonderful perennial cut flower book came out this year by Rachel of Green and Gorgeous Flowers. So it isn't about just annuals. Almost all the cottage garden favourites are very good cut flowers, and it's not necessarily even about picking. I think the nice thing, if you've got your favorite things in pots, if they're not in huge pots, you can bring them inside if you're having just a few people around, a nice pot of flowering thyme, or even a pot of Alchemilla mollis in a pot. You could just plonk that on the table, and in a way that's an arrangement. Or lots of little pots of spring bulbs. I think it's just about, I hate the idea of the garden not being connected to a house.
It's like two separate entities, and it's just not.
Yeah, and that's never been it for me. And also, I think cut flowers are a big comfort. Scents are massive comforts, so honeysuckle, sweet peas, chocolate cosmos. It's all about comfort increasingly for me. And things like mint. So I'm more and more passionate about herbs. Like my new favorite go-to group of plants at the moment.
I totally agree. And it's funny because I was writing a thing earlier about like gap fillers, and I was looking through the patch of dahlias that I'd got, and I've done that thing that I always do where I've planted them too far apart, and I need to put something between them or more between them. And I was looking at different, I suppose, different things, or not the obvious things. And things like dill tetra has just become like one of my favorite filler kind of plants just in the world, like that. And you mentioned about herbs, like herbs are so underrated. I think everyone just thinks of, thyme and mint and whatever, but to have a really well cultivated like herb patch, such a skill. And there's so such a tremendous variety that I just don't think people are aware of.
That they are, and you know, like you, people, I think people just think of mint as the thing that they see in, you know, Tesco,
Yeah.
but the variety of scent is incredible. You know, banana mint, grapefruit mint, strawberry mint,
Yeah.
and they all make very, very good pot plants. Particularly if you're, you know, away from home a lot and you want drought tolerance. It's really funny, isn't it? All these sushi, gorgeous, expensive restaurants and spas and places like that, it's the garnish of mint, isn't it, that makes you think, oh yeah, I'll pay extra for that. But it's all things you can have at home. I mean, my favorite thing is lemon verbena, and I never ever
God,
thought
yeah.
I would be ever interested in lemon verbena, but I have to have it now because I love lemon verbena tea.
Yeah.
And you know, lemon verbena isn't hardy, but all the mints are, rosemary is. And you know, in terms of, you know, having structure in the garden, a rosemary hedge is the most gorgeous thing.
God, yeah, it is.
Flowers as well as looks evergreen. So
Yeah,
the,
they're perfect.
you know, Jacqueline McVicar and Mark Diacono, people who've championed herbs for a long time, they've known about the virtues, but it's for someone like me, it's only since the climate's gone out the window that I'm starting to think, actually, I really need a garden that is more nurturing and less thirsty for water. So for me, I
Yeah.
think herbs are quite quickly, I would say, becoming 60, if not 70% of what's in my pots in the garden now.
Oh God, really?
Yeah, simply because from a cost point of view, and also having things that I know are going to flower for bees and butterflies and scent. And also, it's really interesting how your style changes. You know, my style is rapidly changing, mainly driven by a fear of climate change and an awareness of how the climate's changing. So it's all very well, you know, filling your garden with all these more exotic things, but if we're going to have really, really cold winters, particularly if you're gardening pots, you need things that are going to cope with basically being frozen. So there's a lot of things that you might think are going to be good, but come the winter, they're just going to die.
So you've brought more herbs in. What do you think
A
you've
lot more herbs, yeah.
consciously taken out?
People are going to possibly shop dahlias, a lot less dahlias, mainly because of the excess heat, the heat wave we had last year. I found myself almost depressed due to just feeling like my whole garden was dying. The dahlias in the metal containers, the metal absorbs the heat all through the day and all through the night. The soil is hot still.
It's just boiling, isn't it? Literally
Yeah,
just
so all my dahlias
boiling.
got mildew and they didn't flower particularly well. So less dahlias. I'd say I think I've got four dahlias this year of very, very lovely varieties. So Topia
Wow.
Tangerine, Bishop of Auckland, Blue Bayou. And I think that's Waltzing Matilda, all single ones that the bees like. But yeah, I like them. I love them. I love them, especially as cut flowers. But they are divas, and as are tulips. So this year, I found the tulip display lasted a fortnight. The rain was so heavy. They just lasted like they were like birds of paradise in the cold. They just opened. The rain completely hammered them.
Yeah, they
Thank
did.
God I'd planted geums on top of my tulips, otherwise all the pots in the garden would have just looked dreadful. So I'd rather treat myself to a good £15 geum than spend £15 on tulip bulbs. That's what I'm going to do
Yeah.
this autumn. Every pot's going to have a nice geum put on the top of it. And you know, moving towards more perennial bulbs, more species like tulips that I know are going to come back, at least more scary. You know, I tend to shy away from most narcissi because I'm not a particular lover of white, but I do love pheasant's eye narcissi, you know, again for the
It's the one
scent.
with the red ring around the,
Yeah,
yeah.
beautiful. And yeah, so in a way, my entire garden method, that first book, The Flower Yard, that so many people loved, that is already a bit of history for me. I mean, I will always want some sweet peas. I love growing sweet peas, so I'll always grow them. But will I be planting, you know, I used to plant something like 3,000 tulip bulbs, I think wasn't uncommon. And I'm not going to be doing that again because those tulip bulbs are coming from a monoculture. They're imported, and it's just not sustainable. And I really want to feel that my garden is sustainable and trying its best to help the planet and the wildlife. And, you know, just planting in a mass importation of tulips, sadly for me, is no longer the soul warming thing it used to be.
No, do you know, tulips are my absolute like joy, and I find exactly the same. I'm really glad you said that because I don't think anyone was necessarily sharing that online. And I remember just looking out the window. I did about 2,500 tulips last year, all in pots, or a majority in pots, maybe about 2,000 in pots. And I remember looking at one of the days where it was the really torrential rain and everything was just flopping. And I remember distinctly, I can feel it now, the feeling of my heart just completely sinking and all the effort that I'd put into the planting of them. And they'd just, they'd got, because the thing is, the particularly big ones as well, once that rain's in there and they flop, they're not coming back up. Like, they're just, realistically, they're not. And if they do, they just look a bit crap. And it was just, yeah, it's not sustainable at all. Do you know, there's something you said about the cut flowers from the supermarket thing, which I think is something that more and more people are becoming aware of. But, like, genuinely, I think, I'm hoping that people are starting to change their habits. But I think there's a lot of stubborn people that just buy flowers from the supermarket without any awareness of not just where they're coming from, but all of the stuff around that. Like, what do you, I mean, it's not a such a broad question, but what do you think about supermarket flowers? Because I just think it's something that we've got. I don't know, there needs to be a wider conversation about it. That's such a broad thing to say, but
yeah, I mean, I do go into supermarkets. I'm not, you know, what I love about, not what I do, but I do like being in the real world. And, you know, I'm on the train all the time and I do go into supermarkets. And I think actually this year has been the worst year ever when I've gone into a supermarket and there's been nothing, not one bunch of flowers that I would even want to be given as a gift or want to give anybody else. I haven't seen any Sweet Williams. I mean, Hucknall is very close to Lincolnshire, so I know there are Lincolnshire growers. You know, even the Alstroemeria haven't been the colours I'd want. You know, I used to buy my mum from the supermarket freesias because she loves freesias. I've not seen any freesias. There's more and more dyed things. Like,
oh my God, there's horrible blue.
Roses, just the most. I mean, it's really sad because they're expensive and people buy them, and that is then what people associate a garden with, because for a lot of people that is what they think flowers are. And the issue with the UK, in my opinion, is, unlike the rest of Europe, the reason we've become so precious over wildflowers and not been able to pick them, even to the point where people are scared of picking things like cow parsley, is we've lost, therefore, the connection to what real flowers are in terms of cut flowers. Now, I did a video on Instagram of bluebells, and I said very clearly, these are bluebells out of my grandma's garden and I haven't picked them from the wild. I still had a barrage of comments saying, you shouldn't be picking bluebells, this is illegal, this is wrong. And it's that kind of attitude that I think's made us forget wildflowers and therefore forget garden flowers, because we're just not a society that even dares to pick anything from the roadside anymore. Everything's a weed. So for most people, it's a thing of just going to Tesco and buying what's on offer there. And the supermarkets are absolutely, even, to be honest, I think all of them really need to up their game and really sing from the hymn sheet that they put on the stores saying we support British growers and British farm. In terms of cut flowers, they really haven't done that. M&S have a little bit, but, you know, M&S, they used to be at Chelsea in the Grand Pavilion. You know, they'd get Joanna or Triggy, you know, to represent, these are our cut flowers this year. They've stopped doing that since COVID. It really feels, despite all the passion on Instagram for growing your own cut flowers, for most people, the options are very limited.
Do you know every time this conversation comes up about the British going flowers, you follow a guy called Alstroemeria Ben?
Who's had a real awful time with price wars. I know that, because I've read how he's been treated.
Yeah.
I mean, today we're talking after all the bosses in the supermarkets have been, you know, made to admit how much their wages are.
Yeah.
The supermarkets, I mean, you know, I'm very passionate about British farming and good high welfare farming in terms of farm animals. So I'm reading every day all the stuff that's unravelling. It's absolutely criminal what's going on when you look at the bonuses these huge oligarch supermarket bosses are taking home. Yeah. And then you look at the choice that we've got. It's really scary because, you know, my nan Min, who I looked after all through COVID, that generation of Second World War babies who grew up, you know, really respecting homegrown food and knowing that if they didn't have their own vegetables, if they didn't have their own hens or even their own pig, they weren't going to have that. That generation is moving on now. So what we're left with is the secondary generations who have become used to supermarket food. And that, for huge numbers in society, that's all we've got. So we really are beholden to the supermarkets to supply us with good quality food, and they're just not doing it.
Yeah, it's funny because when I talked to Josie, we talked about, I think it was, yeah, I'm sure it was with Josie. We talked about strawberries and just the fact that it's such a simple thing, but you just expect to have strawberries in January, February, March, April, May,
I
all of
can't stand seeing them. And actually,
them.
I am that horrible person. I'm not very social. This is probably one of the reasons why. I am that kind of person that just goes, well, why are you buying them? I don't understand it. I don't want to see a strawberry. I like strawberries in the summer, and I don't want strawberries out the fridge. I want them warmed by the sun. I don't like being shop bought, but please, they're a summertime treat. If I'm doing a Christmas trifle, the only thing that I can cook, there'll be raspberries that are frozen. I'm not going to buy fresh raspberries in December that are probably from Peru, because I just know the cruelty to the planet that's gone into them. Not just the planet, but to the poor people that have been picking them, who've probably been paid 10 pence, if that, a day. I think because my dad, he would bring the Guardian home, and I would read the Guardian as a little boy, and they've always been very good at doing investigations and supply chains. And I remember reading all this stuff when I was probably, 11, 12, and it's still going on. And
Nothing's changed. Yeah.
nothing has changed. I think it's got worse.
It does seem to. You mentioned about the sustainability element. What are your views on the peat-free thing? I mean, it's not a debate, is it really? But
I do buy peat free. I don't think it's the most pressing issue of the day, to be
no.
honest, and that will be controversial. I'm very allergic to the plastic invasion more, to be honest. I find that more of a worry that people are just choosing to buy a plastic hedge or a plastic box ball,
Jesus, I know.
and that's the garden done. And I say that because, I walk through my hometown, and that's what I see. So you've got your plastic box ball hanging there, and gravel or AstroTurf and fairy lights, I'm afraid. And the hedge goes. People seem to love cutting down a hedge. When my dad moved from the house that we grew up in, which was the other side of town, we planted, when I was probably about 12 on Mother's Day, as a family, a cherry tree for my mum. And that had grown into the most gorgeous tree. And within a week of my dad leaving that house, the cherry tree was just chopped. And my dad's quite bushy, so he didn't knock on the door and said, why's the cherry tree gone? And the wife of the new couple that had moved in just went, I don't know why he's done it. He just went out and did it. And I think people are bored. People are bored, and I think there's so much frustration in a lot of people now that they take it out on trees and the garden, because I think we should all be gardening, but we don't know how to anymore, a lot of us. So I see things like that happening all the time. My mum's very sensitive. She takes note of things that get cut down.
Will she go and knock on the door?
My mum wouldn't know. She'd just have a cry about it.
Internally, she's knocking on the door
Yeah, very much internally.
there. We've glossed over the pot thing, and I can't ignore it because I think that's the first. I think that's how I came to find you originally on Instagram. I think was the pots thing, and I just think there's kind of a swathe of people that have become really known for pots. There's you and there's Klaus and there's a few others. So was it a necessity to grow from pots because of the style of your garden, like the yard, or was it that you then ended up loving, or was it kind of the other way around that you wanted to grow in pots, or was it just both?
I'd say both. I always loved dolly tubs, but it was necessary for me to garden in pots. There was no ground to dig in, and so that was why. And also, I think the thing that really started me gardening was when my parents split up. My mum wasn't in a fit state to really handle moving any of the pots out the old garden to the new garden, so I wheelbarrowed them all across town to the new garden, and I then took on the garden as like mine. And that was the first like year that I started to grow the dahlias and really got into colour. And I think they're wonderful. I really think that they allow people to just stand back and go, oh, I've done something good today. Whereas, I don't know that many people who've got these big gardens that actually take huge amounts of pleasure of them. It's always, oh, come back next week, or come back in a week's time, or oh, so much to do. I mean, I really if I had a big garden, and I do hope to have a big plot of land one day, God knows how, but it would literally be a big terrace full of pots, full of herbs, and then the rest of it would be an orchard full of rose hedges, full of chickens. I wouldn't want great big herbaceous borders, because I just find the people who've got them are often so stressed out and miserable and aren't taking pleasure in the garden. Whereas I do stand back and I go, oh, I love my garden, and I'm just going to sit amongst my pots and have a nice time. And it's not breaking because, you know, a dolly tub or an old dustbin is almost at hip height. So fantastic for the elderly and I think children alike, anyone. Yeah, so they're powerful. I think they're a force of good if you're planting good things in them. And by that, I don't mean plastic bay trees.
Do you know, I wasn't going to mention this, but just before I did all of my tulips last year, I laid out all of my pots in the garage, and took a picture of them and posted them on Instagram. And the very, very first comment on that picture was you that said, first of all, get rid of the plastic. Get rid of
I know.
the
I'm
plastic.
so awful. I really am
No,
awful.
you were right there, and I
No,
have.
I'm
You'll be
awful.
glad to know.
I shouldn't be such a snob. Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest favour you can do to yourself if you are gardening pots is just make them as big as you can, because then the watering is less and you can plant more in them and things are happier because the roots are cooler in the winter and they'll be more insulated in the bigger pot. But the miracle thing this year that I've discovered is lining your pots with wool,
Well,
sheep's fleece, because it holds in the moisture, insulates against the heat, and then insulates against the winter freezing temperatures. So, you know, all the poor shepherds who haven't had a market for their sheep's fleeces, hopefully, if, you know, the RHS and the garden centres really get behind them and package it up nicely, everybody will be wanting sheep's fleece because apparently it's good for slugs as well.
Yeah,
Slugs.
so they say. Have you seen, there's a great company, I don't know if they are new, but I keep seeing them, called Hortiwool, and it's
Yeah.
like a roll of it's British as well, which is great, but it makes it, I mean, it's great for what I've done with a couple of hostas is I've cut a kind of a ring, well, a circle, and then just to slit through the middle just to pop around the bottom of the hostas, and it's like my hostas have been amazing this year because of supposedly the slug thing, and it also slowly feeds as well. I'm not sure exactly the science behind that, but I think as it biodegrades, it feeds. I don't know what the actual science is, but yeah, wool seems to be a thing, doesn't it? And it's good for basket, like baskets and troughs and stuff like that as
Yeah.
well, instead of coir. What do you think about coir?
I've never really used it. I mean, the miracle thing for me is molehill soil. Just getting some proper soil into that compost is a game changer. Particularly for perennial plants and shrubby plants, they love it. They really will then be set up for life. Because all the mycorrhizal all fungi and little things that we will never be able to see it as in that molehill soil. And if you think about it, a mole that's on the, you know, the church green or anywhere that moles shouldn't be, they're bringing up the most gorgeous loam that's never been double dug, or, you know, you see them, don't you? Fresh molehill soil, it looks like the most gorgeous chocolate mix. Get it bagged up in a bag for life and mix it in. It will make any peat-free mix then be superb.
Yeah, of course it will. Chickens. Let's go on to chickens. You know, I'm looking at, I've got your Pottery Gardener book here. I don't know why I'm showing you, because you know what your book looks like. With
Very
you with
well.
a gorgeous chicken. Was that one of your chickens?
It was a cockerel called Charlie, who was a complete
Charlie.
rapist. He wasn't very nice to his hens at all.
Did
Horrible, horrible cockerel, but it looks very cute there.
you have chickens when you were younger, or is that something you've purely
Well,
come
from the age
to?
of 7, I had them after
Right.
begging for a long time. But that book, I'm very, you know, that book brings back such nice memories of having rare breed chickens in a garden that was on public display. It was very much a Beatrix Potter kind of garden to have them in, and you know, they'd be fostering duck eggs and having ducklings following a broody hen, and it was such a lovely, very stressful job because it was only me doing it, and I created a garden that was A, very intensive, and B, was almost like a small farmyard. So
This
it
was at
was,
Emma Bridgewater, wasn't it?
yeah, in Stoke-on-Trent, and the garden is still there. It's being gardened by a lovely, lovely, lovely woman, and she's really nurturing it. So do go and visit it if you fancy some Bridgewater pottery.
Has it changed much since you were there?
Yeah, I mean, it's what's nice is when I visited it just a few weeks ago, and it's become much more what I feel a garden should be. It's more perennials and roses and loads of lavender and perennial sweet peas, and there's a new entrance, so you find it much more easily. And the chickens aren't there anymore, but that's because, you know, I left with the chickens all belonged to me. So obviously when I left, I wasn't going to leave them. So we all left together. And so no, it's a lovely, you know, it's very beautiful little oasis to find. It's quite unexpected and very, you know, very beautiful, like a little cottager with these lovely apple trees and pears that have been espaliered. So no, it was very sweet to go back.
Yeah, I bet. How many chickens have you got now?
I've got 15 here in Nottingham. Which are a mixture of bantams and one hen called Linda, who's accompanied me on this like chicken book tour because she's very, very tame. Claudia is also very tame. She comes on the radio sometimes. But I'm hoping to be setting up a new kind of chicken flock. I'm going to rent some land on a friend's farm
Mm.
and plant an orchard and have it properly fenced and really indulge in chickens because they really are what make me happy. They don't mix into a small garden that well. You know, they do like to peck and scratch, and that's what they're designed to do. But for me, you know, what for me, there could be nothing nicer than having a very perennial based garden with lots of roses and herbs and lots of fruit bushes, you know, wildflower meadows. They do fit in very well to a garden like that. They're not going to fit in well to a garden that's, you know, being dug over all the time and, you know, bedding plants. They'll trample everything. And with the bird flu, the best scenario you could do for keeping them in a garden would be probably to invest in a very good fruit cage, reinforce it all the sides with very robust chicken wire, and then have them in there because that means when the bird flu legislation comes in, when they have to be kept in inverted commas, they've then got a roofed area that will be within legislation. So that's what I'd recommend to do. And you could plant that fruit cage up with all of these soft fruit. You know, red currants and all the rest of it, and they'll have a lovely canopy to peck at. That's how I recommend kind of keeping chickens in a smallish garden.
So you wrote a book about your chicken fancy. Is that the
Yeah,
correct term? It's pigeon fancy. It's not chicken
no,
fancy.
no poultry chicken fancy, and
Is
yeah,
it?
poultry fancy.
So what was the what's the what does the book without giving it all away, obviously, what does the book take us through?
So it's a little bit of memoir. Why I love the chickens and how I grew up with them. But then what I enjoyed doing was I drew all the different breeds and then split them all up into different flocks. So if you're just new to chickens, there's so many breeds that you can easily get the breed that is not suitable for you or isn't going to lay as many eggs as you'd like or isn't going to be like a cuddly little pet. So there's different flocks for different people, you know, going from people who maybe have just got room for two bantams in a small garden, right the way to someone who maybe has got a farmyard or stable block and they want things that can fly and a lot more, you know, old English in their heritage. So it's a celebration really of the old breeds and the pure breeds that really need a lot of conservation by being kept by people who can keep them because they're dying out. There's a lot of chickens on the planet, but the percentage that are the old breeds and actually breeds that are healthy and are going to lay nice eggs is diminishing because you know most chickens on earth have been bred to either grow so fat within 6 weeks or lay so many eggs they're pretty much spent within a very short time frame.
Are they expensive to buy, chickens?
Yeah,
Like normally?
they are. I mean, they're more expensive than ever before, mainly because it takes so much money to feed them now, you know, since Ukraine. But to be honest, even people who have begrudgingly paid what I've told them, you know, when people say, "Where do I get chickens from?" and I say, "Well, leg balls abroad rare good, or chickens to the door." You know, most chickens now are between 40 and £50 if you're buying them point of lay, which is when they're 18 weeks old. So they're not far off starting to come in to start laying their first eggs. Once you get that first egg, all the cost evaporates because it's the most gorgeous thing. There's nothing like a freshly laid egg. It just everything you could buy pales into comparison, unless you're look, you know, if you can't have your own chickens, do try and find someone who's got them and buy your eggs from there because those chickens will have had a much better time than anything in the supermarket.
Do you know, just going back to what you said about the book and about the illustrations that you drew, I'm literally going through my pile of books that I've got here. I have got three copies of The Flower Yard, and
Oh.
I'll explain why. One I bought when it came out because I wanted it. Second one I bought, which was signed from Sarah's site because I wanted to sign one. And then the
Oh,
third one was one that you signed and drew a flamingo in and put it in Hatchard's in St Pancras. Do you remember?
really?
And then
Oh,
I
amazing.
bought it and got them to send
Oh, it was
it.
even coloured in.
Yeah.
So if I die, that'll be worth the most.
So I've got three copies of that. I absolutely, it's, I hate to say it, it's such a bandied about like phrase about it being a Bible, but I just
I don't know. It's perfect. I genuinely, it's just such a perfect book. And you can, I find myself reading it kind of in a kind of with a narrative. Do you know what I mean? I read it as a book rather than just an informative book. And the thing is, I feel like I read it in a few different ways. I read it for the text, but then I found myself just flicking through and not even reading the text and just for the pictures as well. It's
Oh,
such a
that's very nice to know. I mean, I try and write like I'm talking. I'm not very good at doing step by step, very like tutor like writing. So that's lovely to know. It was a luxury to write, I think, any book during lockdown, and
Was
that was
this based on your garden? Or was it
yes.
all in Nottingham?
I mean, I do all my own photography, so yeah, it very much. I mean, it's the same garden that I'm looking out the window at now, which looks very different actually. And so I'm looking forward to doing more Flower Yard books. I mean, maybe they'll go on and on because
What's
that's
the next one is so that's out in October. What's the what does that continue the story or?
a little bit. It's kind of this the one that's coming out in October has really caught me in between changing my gardening ethos. So I think you'll definitely get a much more talkative book at the one that's coming out in October. It's of a similar flavour, but there's lots of updated varieties, and there's a moving into more perennials, more herbs, and I think for me, I'm most excited about in it is my butterfly drawings in it. It's one of those last minute things when the book's getting put together, and the people at the publisher start putting in icons of like WordArt, and you go, what's that horrible white flower blob? And I went, well, I'll draw things if you want images. So I quickly drew these butterflies over the weekend, sent them in. I mean, I do, I'm not a nice person to live with when I'm writing and doing these books because I do find it very stressful. I think because I do my own photos, the writing, it's all on me to create this thing that I at least hand in and think, oh, that's all right. It's amazing how people have been so lovely about it. I mean, I do read the reviews on Amazon, and I do read all the comments, and it's so humbling. I'm so grateful. I mean, God, my following on Instagram is incredible. These people who, are willing to go on Amazon and do a proper like book review, I just bowled over by them.
Well, it's only because it's a fantastic book, and I'm really excited for the second one because I think
Hope
I
so.
and especially now that we've talked and you're talking about how things have changed, because that's going to be exciting to see that difference, that point of difference between this. How when was this? When was this? When did this come
It was 2000, and I should have a copy, shouldn't I, just to
out?
get, but I don't. You'll have to look at one
I
of
need
yours.
to look, don't I? So this one that you've written that's coming out in
It was
October, has that been written
2020,
this year?
so it was handed in. You have to do all these books so far in bloody advance. It was handed in, I think, this first week of January of this year. So that, it's a funny thing, this garden writing, because the planet is changing so quickly, and gardens are so in tune with the planet, so already it's feeling a little bit like, oh God, I wish I could go back in and put a bit more. It's like I'm desperate to find a gorgeous water butt to photograph, because every garden is going to need a water butt, I'm afraid.
God.
We all I think we are just on the cusp of really having to change dramatically. I'm trying not to sound too pessimistic, but I am scared. I'm definitely suffering from eco anxiety at the moment because it's just scary.
What else do you think is going to change? What in terms of how we garden? What do you think is
I
going to be
just
the biggest
think from
change?
a financial perspective, from and I just worry what is going to happen when those supermarkets really can't get the stuff in them. Like we did experience a bit in COVID. I remember, just before lockdown, going into a big Tesco with my friend Caroline, and it felt like you were in a horror film. All those empty shelves and people scrambling for food, just buying anything they could get in their trolleys.
I remember. It's funny you say that because I remember that first trip when it suddenly became. Someone mentions the fact that you can't get toilet roll when you still could at that point, but then suddenly it went stupid. I remember going in that first. So we'd got one daughter at that point. We've got two now. But I remember standing in the fruit and veg aisle and everything was empty. And I remember it feeling genuinely like a film. Like it went. It was like it was slow motion. And I was spinning around, looking at everything. This is over the top slightly, but I remember looking and thinking, "Well, what am I going to buy?"
No, it was really scary,
It
really,
was.
because I think we all most of us are relying on on supermarkets for food now. So to be honest, even someone like me who is, openly, I can't grow vegetables, I am wanting at least herbs in the garden, so I at
Yeah.
least have them to put in some horrible bread if that's all I can buy.
Nice
And
mint sandwich.
I think trees, I think,
Yeah.
trees, what could be nice, you get the blossom, then you get the fruit. And we're lucky, we are a country that has got amazing nurseries, amazing variety of grafted miniature fruit trees, and we got I'm part of me is excited. I love figs, so I really want lots of figs in my garden. And so yeah, but I mean, who knows, if we can start growing passion flowers, that might be a bonus. Get them to fruit.
It'll be interesting.
It's not all doom and gloom, but it is scary when, I'm reading reports by Dave Gorson about, bumblebees, if it gets too hot, they're just going to only be in Scotland, a lot of them. So I think our gardens rapidly need to nurture us more, and also things like the bees. I think they really have got the potential, but we're still quite a way away from feeling like we're there. The AstroTurf has got to be limited.
Don't. I'm not going to get you started on AstroTurf
No, otherwise we'll be here till midnight.
because Well, I've got three questions for you now, and I'm going on to this because the first one I think links really nicely to what we were just saying. So I've got three questions for you that I've purposely not told you because I want a nice genuine reaction to these. But the first one, I think we haven't. I don't know what the answer will be, but based on what we've talked about, I mean, it really could be anything. If you, I mean, you're literally looking at your window at your garden now. If you look at it as it is right now, if that was completely empty and you were to start it from scratch, given where we are in the climate and whatever now, what would be the first thing that you would do, or where would you start?
In terms of what plants I'd get,
Just what? So if you just got a blank yard that you were looking at now, where would you start if you were to start it completely again?
that's a really good question. I think I would be tempted to try and echo what is there in terms of getting nice sandstone, and I'd maybe try and make good raised beds out of sandstone in places where at the moment there's pots. So, nice big raised beds of lovely sandstone on top of the brick, because it's a brick yard. I suppose I know roots do go through the brick, because the brick I've got isn't, hard horrible mortar. So yeah, I'd definitely work on the bones. I'd also work on the privacy, so probably more hazel hurdles. And in terms of planting, I'd definitely get lots of honeysuckle in, with honeysuckle, and it dresses walls and things so well. My favourite plant at the moment that's honestly been in flower since the end of April is the Salvia genensis, Natch TB Linda,
Oh my God,
which is literally like a lavender hedge for us, because we're in a town, so it lasts through even the cold winter. It lasted. Bees love it. I love the scent of it, and it just billows out like big purple clouds.
They get huge, don't they?
Very long answer. I'm sorry.
No, God, the longer the better. You've really, I don't, you've obviously not done this consciously because you don't know the questions, but you've linked really nicely to the next one. What is your favorite scent in the garden and why?
Probably, I do love sweet peas. I mean, I've said, I'm moving towards herbs, but I will always probably want a very big and deep pot full of lovely sweet pea matricana or Cupini,
Oh my God. Yeah.
because they are. And I love the fact that I can sow sweet pea seeds on Boxing Day, or between Boxing Day and New Year, and that kind of starts the seed sowing year off for me. And I really nurture those little seedlings and get them. Then I go and forage the silver birch or the hazel and make a nice wigwam. So I love the ritual of the sweet peas, and the scent is gorgeous.
And the last question, it's a big question, sorry, but why does gardening bring you so much joy?
Feeling that I'm nurturing the planet in my the only way that I possibly can, but by just opening the door and planting things and seeing the bees and just feeling just beauty. It's accessible beauty, isn't it, for anybody? And that, for me personally, that is the biggest tonic. I can be having a really awful day, and if I just do a little bit, I don't like that slogan, gardening's going to save your mental health, because I think you do need a little bit more if it's serious mental health. But it definitely helps you, just to feel like you've done something worthwhile.
Arthur's latest book, Planting a Paradise, is out on the 12th of October from Octopus Publishing Group, which is part of Hachette UK and can be pre-ordered now in all good bookshops, but do make an effort to support your local bookshop if you have one. You can find Arthur on Instagram at arthurparkinson_ to see more of his garden, his hens and the bees, and not forgetting all those clips of Ab Fab too. Join me again next week where I'll be in conversation with another fantastic planty guest. Until then, you can follow me on Instagram at viewfromthepottingbench to see what I'm up to in my garden, or visit viewfromthepottingbench.com to read my blog and much more.